Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. It's hard to believe that the bloodiest battle in all of American history is mostly forgotten. But it is, and that's a huge mistake, says our guest Edward Lengel. He is author of To Conquer Hell, The Meuse Argonne, 1918. In it, he shows remarkable similarities between the United States' actions today and its role in World War I, of which this noteworthy battle was a part. As a military historian, Dr. Lengel is keenly aware that World War II overshadows World War I, but such forgetfulness is risky business, he says. World War I had a profound effect on a whole lot more than how wars are fought.
At the beginning of that war, the idea had always been that fighting is something that you do as a debt to your society. It's your duty to your society. World War I creates for the first time this idea that society also owes something to the soldiers, that there is a sense of entitlement, that it goes both ways. For the first time, the veterans really force society to realize that you need to help us. You need to help us get back into society. You need to support us and give us pensions. And it developed really that idea of the social contract.
Edward Lengel is an author and historian. In To Conquer Hell, he tells the soldiers' stories of the bloodiest battle in American history, including that of his cousin, portrayed by Cary Grant in the movie Sergeant York. Dr. Lengel's other military history books include General George Washington, A Military Life. Dr. Lengel received the National Humanities Medal in conjunction with the Papers of George Washington Documentary Editing Project, was a finalist for the George Washington Book Prize, and makes frequent appearances on television documentaries. Bill Russell and I were both impressed by the disturbing similarities between America's role in the world then and now. We seize the opportunity to explore both more thoroughly when Dr. Lengel's labor of love brought us together for this conversation. Edward Lengel, when I was little, I had a music teacher who adored children. In fact, I could read music before I could read words. She adored children. And I remember my mother, who was her good friend, saying somewhat carefully, "Well, Frances Sherwood, you love children, so why don't you have lots of your own or some?" And Frances Sherwood, may she rest in peace, said, "I lost my redheaded doughboy." Mm. And all these years later, that chill goes, and I said, "Mommy, what's a doughboy?" Thinking, you know, this is gingerbread or something. That was a larger truth, that when you're a little kid, you have no idea. To have lost one's redheaded doughboy as I grew up was a big category. Where did that category go?
It's disappeared. The doughboy has really disappeared out of our consciousness. And I can't understand why. I can speculate, but I don't know why. And I think so many families, if they take the trouble to look back, they have stories like that. I mean, my grandfather used to tell me about his uncle who had served in World War I. And he was with Pershing in the Mexican excursion. Now, a very healthy, handsome young man. Then they sent him over to fight in France. He came home. He was not counted as a casualty on the casualty rolls. Came home, and his lungs were destroyed by poison gas. And he died when he was only 42 years old.
People don't even remember what mustard gas and all of these other gases.
Phosphine and things we don't blessedly hear much about now.
Yeah, the First World War was just all about gas and all about all kinds of things we don't hear about. That was the First World War.
Right, right.
The war to end all wars.
Right.
Which, of course, is the other part of that. When I've gotten sort of accustomed to, okay, I'm an American, I don't know my history. First World War is just so a way you can talk about the Second World War. Mm-hmm. Going back and looking at the First World War, what have we missed?
I hate to say it, but I think one of the reasons Americans don't follow the First World War is because the entertainment value is low. Now, when Americans talk about World War I, if they talk about it at all, they're interested in the flying aces, mm-hmm. possibly in the volunteer ambulance drivers like Ernest Hemingway, But you get into all that nasty, bloody stuff
Sergeant York.
Sergeant York, you know, that's an inspiring story. You can have a Gary Cooper who will present that, you know, in a really inspiring kind of way. But they don't want to hear about the trenches. They don't want to hear about the poison gas, which incidentally affected the Americans really more than any other combatant.
Because
their training was horrible. They didn't know how to use their masks. They didn't know how to react to gas. So they were just sent over there. And proportionately, a much larger number of Americans died of poison gas than did British, French, or Germans. If you look as a proportion of total casualties, that's true. But again, Americans just, they don't want to go there. Now, if you contrast that to the British, the French, the Germans, the Belgians, they still very much have that in their consciousness, and they remind their children, to get back to children again, they remind their children of this all the time.
I was taken with one of the many wonderful lines in your book, To Conquer Hell. You talked about how the Americans, this is 350 pages in, that things had gotten so grim that it was as if they'd been there 4 years instead of 4 months. Well, the Brits, the French, all of the imperial people, the people from New Zealand, the people from Australia, Senegal, you talk about the Senegalese, they'd been there for 4 years. And the Americans came in really late with huge numbers, although they thought it was going to be bigger numbers. And it's as if, it's another fad. And enormous numbers of people's lives ended and were affected brutally.
Right. And it's a shame and ironic and tragic the arrogance with which the American commanders in particular came into that war. There was, and you can draw modern parallels with this as well, that there was this unwillingness to listen, to learn, to find out what the Europeans had gone through, what the Europeans had suffered, and what they had learned. You know, the Europeans by 1918, the British and French in particular, had learned a lot. And in fact, their methods of handling this kind of fighting were much better. They had a way of minimizing casualties. The casualties were still horrendous, but they had a much better sense of combined arms and all this other stuff. And the Americans' attitude was, the Europeans, we don't have anything to learn from them. Their morale has been ruined by war. All they want to do is hide in their trenches.
They don't think it's fun anymore.
Yeah, they don't think it's fun anymore. They don't have the, it's true. That's a blunt way of putting it, but it's true. Because they don't have the spirit. They don't have the gung-ho kind of spirit that we Americans can do.
I found myself early on in this book, one of these speeches about spirit, and I said, if somebody puts a gun to your head and pulls the trigger, all the spirit in the world is not going to do anything for you. And that is, in a lot of cases, pretty much what was happening.
I'm going to break so that we can come back and I don't have to interrupt again for a while. This is the Paula Gordon Show. It is our great pleasure, Bill Russell's and mine, to be with Edward Lengel. We're talking about the First World War, which he has focused in his book, To Conquer Hell, looking at one, and we'll talk about this when we come back in a moment, one very particular campaign that was crucial in the First World War and is remarkably current in its applicability. Be with us when we return. Welcome back. Edward Lengel is with us. Bill Russell?
Before we get away from gas, we have been fairly cavalier, this country, the United States, in the last few years about the Geneva Conventions. And one of the reasons those conventions are in place are the kinds of atrocities that occurred during the First War, specifically gas, and the agreement among nations after that about various types of warfare, but gas right at the center of it. Everybody agreed that that was uncivilized and that even by war standards, that was unacceptable.
Chemical warfare was more or less banned.
And it seems to me that we, ignoring these conventions, treating them as if they are just, that's the old days and that was something that Europeans agreed to or whatever, is an extraordinary step backward and dangerous.
Right. If you, we can move ahead to the Second World War. the Second World War holds object lessons to how horrible and brutal warfare can become when those conventions are ignored. If you look at the Eastern Front in World War II or the Pacific War in World War II, in both of those fronts, the Geneva Conventions were ignored. And
as they are as being ignored by the United States in things like torture.
Sure, sure.
But this isn't, you know, history is not the past.
That's right. Right, but even in World War II on the Western Front, the Nazis didn't use poison gas in battle, and nobody else did. It was an accepted that this, you know, the Geneva Conventions really protect in some ways the standards of Western civilization.
Well, it's also
the
worth
standards of Western civilization that
as much as you can do in a war, which, you know, war itself, you know.
Well, you know, we pretty much came face to face with total warfare and the destructiveness of that, not only to the armies but to everything.
Right.
And we forget how important the Russians were in the Second War. We tend to take all the credit for that. And the Russians, had the Russians not done what they did,
including 40 million people
suffering lots of casualties in the process, it would have been a very different war. And because of the way the Germans attacked on the Eastern Front, the response when the Soviets moved into Germany, I mean, it sounds like we're drifting away from the First World War, but this is all, I mean, there are direct sure. connections. And the basically the atrocities that the Russians perpetrated on the German army, but the German people, right. have to be traceable at least in parts. It's not a justification necessarily, but it is understandable that given what the behavior of the German army in Russia and in getting to Russia, generated some of the response at the end of the war.
You mean the first
and I'm talking about the Second War, and I'm talking right. about, you know, what essentially became the Iron Curtain, mm-hmm. and, right. and the reasons for that, and a lot of it had to do with ignoring these conventions.
Right. And you bring up the subject of, you know, modern industrialized warfare. You know, again, one of my points in this book is that the Doughboys were the first generation of American soldiers to truly experience modern industrialized warfare. You know, a lot of people talk about the Civil War. The Civil War is the first total war. I don't really buy that. I mean, compared to World War I and what went on in that war in so many different aspects, World War I was a much you know, more of what we think of as a total war. And the experience for those young men who had absolutely nothing to prepare them psychologically, physically, for what they experienced there, it could not help but be transforming.
Well, and you're saying the soldiers, not the officers.
Yes.
Because the officers are still pre-industrial war.
Well, talking about the general officers, the major generals, you know, the others, most of them, I would say, there were some exceptions. There were some who were willing to adapt. But many of them, like Pershing and the others, really were still locked in the past and unwilling to adapt. But the younger officers, lieutenants, captains, majors, colonels, many of them, you know, they were in there with their troops.
That's the difference,
they experienced
isn't it?
The same thing. That's the difference.
The being in the, time and again, you distinguish the officers who are leading their men from the front versus the guys who are sitting in the office saying, "Oh no, attack, attack." Having no clue what these people have been through.
Well, you used a word early on that was arrogance, and that word keeps cropping up hither and yon. And I would guess there were tens of thousands, probably more, casualties by virtue of that arrogance, the refusal to learn, the belief that that the American soldier was bigger, brighter, smarter, more effective, that all they had to do was have a good esprit de corps, pardon the French, and they would go, you know, and they would just bowl over all these people, and they'd show how mediocre the British were and how mediocre the French were.
And they said those things.
Oh, sure. And now compare this, though. An interesting comparison. Compare this to how the French and the British and the Germans went into war in 1914. We hear a lot about that, about how arrogant they were and how foolish they were. But they had no way of knowing what this war was going to be about. They had no way of knowing what it was going to be like. In 1917, 1918, Pershing and the others had every way of knowing. They observed the war. They saw what had happened. The British and French told them what it was like.
And
but they
already
wouldn't
had
listen.
36,000 miles of trenches in place.
Right. Well, that's why I said, you know, all the in my book, I said they had all the arrogance and twice the stupidity of the French in 1914. And that was really the case.
Elan.
Yeah, Elan.
Right. Elan being spirit, and that somehow, and guts, I think is how you say it translated.
Right. And the comparison to me, having grown up in the South, the Civil War is still very much a part of life.
Sure.
But I found myself regularly reading about these charges, thinking of General Pickett at right. Gettysburg. Mm. And the difference is that these soldiers, the Union Army, Pickett being a Confederate general, the Union Army did have artillery, but not the kind of artillery the Germans had, and it was front-on artillery. The Pickett's army was not essentially surrounded,
right.
which regularly happened with these charges. Secondly, the Union Army did not have machine guns, which was, you know, apparently a fairly effective killing machine. And thirdly, they had a stone wall between them and the charging Confederates. But they didn't have 20 feet, 30 feet, 40 feet of more or less impenetrable barbed wire.
Mm-hmm.
Pickett's charge is generally considered, and this is the part I find amazing about these generals. I mean, they had to have studied that. A lot of them were West Point graduates. The logic, Pickett, I mean, Lee sent Pickett there because he had come to believe in the elan of his troops and effectively destroyed his army in the process. I find it just mysterious that people who have been educated West Point could not see what they were doing under these circumstances. And again, I guess it has to go back to arrogance.
Selective memory. It's really, right. You know, they had, obviously they'd been taught about Pickett's charge, just as they had been taught about what had happened in 1914 and 1916. But they didn't want to remember certain things. They didn't want to think about certain things because they didn't mesh with their overall theory, which is that individual spirit and will is what wins battles.
With a shotgun?
Yeah, I know.
Well, a rifle as your primary weapon in modern warfare?
It's interesting. A first-hand experience of that. First of all, I'd really recommend more people to go and visit these battlefields because they're really much as they were in 1918.
And this specifically would be?
The Meuse-Argonne battlefields, which are near Verdun. If you go there and you see where the Americans fought, you can still trace all the trenches, you can still trace all the pits, everything, the bunkers. The problem is all the trenches, all the pits, all the bunkers are German. The Americans did not dig trenches, and that was partly because they were on the attack, but it's partly also because Pershing and the other commanders ordered them not to dig in. They were not to dig in. They were to be on the attack. So, you know, they would, as it's recounted in this book, very often the attack would stall, and they'd be stuck in one place for several days under heavy artillery bombardment. You look at this. Where are the trenches? Where did they dig in? How did they find protection? They didn't, because they weren't supposed to.
And the thing that I found equally remarkable is they get these bizarre, destructive, horrible orders, and they follow them.
It's the military way, though. I mean, I've always been fascinated by the First War for precisely the reason Paul is saying. British leadership was weak in a lot of cases, French leadership. I mean, the absolute destructiveness of human beings,
mm-hmm.
starting early on, these frontal assaults. And as you say, the French and the British sort of got over that. But it's still the death toll in that war was just staggering. I mean, this, you know, it puts a new spin on the notion of cannon fodder.
Right.
And yet, without a lot of exceptions, the French did mutiny.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans started working their way, at least the German Navy, toward the end. The Russians
had a revolution.
Yeah, they had a revolution.
But then they had Lenin, and you know, to sort of help them through that. But the willingness of people to follow, I won't say blindly, but to follow orders that are manifestly absurd. Well, they, you know, it's essentially, you know, time after time, it's a pretty good approximation of suicide. A certain amount of that you have to have in order to have the kind of discipline necessary to fight wars. Nobody wants to go out and get killed.
Right.
Right. But at some point, it seems that there is, you know, at some point, you say enough.
Well, let us say enough so that I don't have to interrupt when we come back in just a moment with Edward Lengle. His book, To Conquer Hell, specifically looks at the Meuse Argonne in 1918 and says more about warfare than I would ever thought possible in one engagement. Please be with us when Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, Edward Lengle return in a moment. We're back. Edward Lengle is our guest. I'm Paula Gordon. Bill Russell, you were just asking of Edward Lengle, how do you get to enough?
Well, I mean, this is part of the learning that should be going on in these things.
And well, carried forward to the moment.
There is an encouraging subplot, which is in the book, which is that as the battle progresses, on the ground, the individual doughboys and their junior officers in particular learn and adapt and begin to develop their own tactics and their own methods of dealing with the war, which are far superior to what their generals are telling them. So that, you know, in a way, they start fighting their own war. They start improvising. And also learning sometimes from French advisors about how to fight. So that once you get toward November 1918,
Starts in September, so it's right. It's a matter of days and weeks.
Right, and in particular with the veteran units. The veteran units are much more adept at handling this kind of combat, and they are able to reduce casualties. They're able to fight in a more intelligent way. The problem is, part of the problem with this battle, at the beginning of the battle, is that almost all of the divisions that were put into this battle were completely green, completely inexperienced.
Straight off the farm.
Right, straight off the farm, literally.
Or Manhattan.
Or straight out of Manhattan, straight out of Chicago, you know, places like that. Really all segments of society, a large proportion were immigrants, many of whom spoke English barely, if at all. So these are guys, you know, who have no experience of fighting, have no idea what it's like, neither do their officers, and they do what they're told. They follow their orders, you know, they're brave. Incredibly brave, very patriotic. They believe in what they're fighting for. They believe in their buddies, especially, which really is why men fight. As they fight for their comrades. And they keep attacking and attacking and attacking. But as time goes on, even those who went into the battle as green troops really begin to develop their own methods and styles of fighting.
There's another piece of this that we haven't talked about. Two pieces, really. One is the weather. And the other is the logistics. Mm-hmm. I'm accustomed to thinking of the First War as trench warfare, and people would get up out of the trenches and go get themselves killed, and then they get thrown back or not. That part, you know, was not terribly surprising. The absolute failure of the logistics, or close to failure, breakdown of the supply system of the American Expeditionary Force, I found it remarkable. And again, it's understandable because they had a million troops. They didn't have any experience, but they were unable to get food. They were unable to get ammunition.
Water.
I mean, these people, you know, having launched these attacks in many cases with suffering severe casualties, wounded and dead. The wounded could not be evacuated. They got no food. They got no warmth. They were soaked to the skin. They had no shelter. And they ran out of ammunition.
And then
readily.
There was the influenza that comes on top of all of that.
Right, have a nice day.
Yeah, but we're used to thinking of the American soldiers as being the best supplied soldiers in the world. They always have enough of everything, enough food, you know, enough clothing, and everything else. And in this war, in this battle,
in
particularly, oh, that's true. And Iraq is different. But just thinking, you know, in terms of, you know, World War II, you know, or even Vietnam. I mean, in terms of, you know, their you know, that they had generally the senses, enough food and enough water and everything, even though the combat conditions were horrendous.
Well, in Vietnam, the one thing that the Army did extraordinarily well was to evacuate wounded. Mm-hmm. And one of the real horrors of one of many, but I think, you know, probably the greatest is all the soldiers on all sides, but specifically the Americans, who were wounded and were left sometimes for days, sometimes, I guess, some probably for weeks, before they either die or find their own way back or just suffer. Right. And it's appalling.
Right, right.
And the attempts to deal with it didn't seem substantive.
There are many aspects to it. One of them is incompetence, lack of training. Another is the fact that the Americans decided to create their divisions twice as large as the European divisions. So you have a division in a certain small area, and it's just terribly difficult to supply. But it's remarkable also that the army was there to fight at all, because essentially they had just finished another battle, San Miguel, which wasn't much of a battle, but they had to fight there. Then they were shifted in a period of 2 weeks to a completely different front. If George Marshall hadn't been able to accomplish that, they wouldn't have been there at all. But they did it in such a slapdash manner that they were just unprepared to go into that battle. You
know? There's a certain improvised quality to all of this that, I think it goes to that arrogance that because we're Americans, all we have to do is show up. And if the Germans don't run just because we're there, then we'll just steamroll them.
And that really was the attitude. Bill is not making that up. That's more or less descriptive from moment to moment.
I'm interpolating from what I read of your
book. But not much.
Right. Well, part of my, or really my, I should say, my main view in writing this book, it's been written about a couple of times before, briefly.
The specific
battle. And World War I in general, it's always been looked at from the top down. What the generals were doing, what the politicians were doing. We moved one division here, another division there, corps from here to there. This attacked on that front and took that town. But there has been no attempt to look at this from the bottom up, what the individual soldiers were experiencing. And it's not as if there isn't source material. I mean, the source material is just incredibly rich, incredibly rich. Published and unpublished. The problem is that nobody looks at it. Nobody reads it. Nobody's interested, which to me is stunning. So, I try to look at, what it was like for the individuals to come in. And they had a certain naivete. I look at it from the point of view of the doughboys. Yes, they were naive. Yes, in many cases, they were arrogant. But they experienced firsthand what war was really like. And like all other soldiers too, throughout time, they learned to adapt. They learned what war was truly about, and I have a tremendous sympathy, really, for them. That's really what the war is about,
and a personal sympathy as well.
Right,
and that is your cousin.
Right, Alvin C. York is my cousin.
That's right. And it's important because it grounds it in the personal and. As in most things in life, the personal is also the general. Forgive the double entendre there. We're going to be back in just a moment with Edward Lengel. We're talking about the First World War because America needs to do that, and the world needs to do that, and because we don't do it nearly enough, he says. He also says many other things in his eloquent book, To Conquer Hell. He's looking at the Meuse-Argonne campaign in 1918, and there's a great deal that and brings us into the present as well. Be with us when we return in a moment. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. It is our pleasure to be with Edward Lengel, Bill Russell, and I, Paula. You have, in your wonderful story-based look at this horrendous thing called the First World War, from the perspective of American soldiers and German soldiers in this Meuse-Argonne campaign in 1918, which is very much toward the end of the war and part of why the war ends. You have this line that farm boys had become men and men had become comrades. And to me, that was an essential part of this story, was these farm boys or city slickers. Mm-hmm. One guy is a Philadelphia playwright or something. Mm-hmm. That you'd taken the essential American experience, which is all kinds of people from all kinds of walks of life. They grow up in this battle, and then they bond to each other. And in a way, that was one of the things that helped me get through these terrible, terrible stories, to remember that people can do that, that we can grow up, that we can become comrades, that there is, it's like democracy, and that America had done something really important in this mad encounter.
Right. And that's one of the things that has always fascinated me. I have to say, I've written some other books on history and George Washington. This book I really wrote for love of the subject, and the fascination in particular psychologically of how these young guys, and women as well, experienced many horrible things. Young women who went over and served as nurses or as ambulance drivers, as the case may be.
Or YMCA showing
right.
up and giving out
sure.
chocolate.
Sure. And for them, that was also a transforming experience. But particularly for the Doughboys, you know, how they encountered this and how they were able individually to overcome or not to overcome, in many cases, what they went through and how they grew. And most soldiers, I mean, the first thing to say is that there was no one way that every soldier responds to battle. Each is going to respond to war in his or her own individual way. And that was true of the Doughboys too. But for, I would say, most of them, they said the war was horrible. The Meuse-Argonne in particular was horrible. But it wasn't all bad. There were some redeeming aspects of being in a war. And the one major redeeming aspect is the comradeship, is that bond that soldiers form when they're fighting together. They're fighting side by side, which is completely different from any other bond, you know, in the human experience. It's completely different from the bond of man and wife. It's completely different from the bond of close friends. You know, it's something that transcends that. And all of them said that, you know, that there was something in that made it, if not worthwhile, at least had a redeeming quality to it.
You quote, I think, from Patton's autobiography. I think it's Patton, right, who wrote a little doggerel poetry about just how wonderful war is and mm-hmm. how terrible it is when we don't have a war and how much he's looking forward to having another one. And he got it. He got his wish.
Yeah.
And I found myself thinking, I mean, there are people for whom that is the defining experience. That is what they live for.
Right.
You know, they're essentially the warrior class. And we've had those for,
as always.
Probably for 180,000 years, however long old the species is. And I found myself thinking, you know, maybe we should just create a place for those people. Because you need them sometimes, but there are people on both sides that have that attitude.
Right.
The problem is they keep wanting to drag the rest of us into it.
Right.
Both military, but also civilians. And, you know, there are times when some of those attributes are admirable, but they are dangerous to a civilization. They're dangerous to a democracy. They're dangerous to a people. And sometimes I think we just ought to find a place for them so they can go out and if they must, kill one another and get them off of our playground.
One of the most, I think, moving stories in here is I found the account by a young corporal with the 1st Division, Donald Kyler, I think his name was, who during the war was a real no-nonsense, gung-ho soldier who really enjoyed combat. Now, he really enjoyed fighting. But he writes after the war, as he begins to reflect back on that, he says, that turned me into something bad, into a kind of person who's dangerous even to civilization, is dangerous to democracy. And he felt like he was, because of what he had become in that war, and he was only a teenager. Because of what he had become, he felt himself really that he's in some ways had become a menace.
Well,
and
his word
felt terrible about it.
His word was authoritarian, I think.
Right.
And effectively,
right.
He'd become what he had been fighting
right.
against.
Right. And I think his moment of seeing that, it was really, really touching to me, is when he was coming back home on the troop ship. And now he had always believed in absolutely iron discipline. But on this ship, one of his buddies has snuck on board a miniature dachshund. You know, all the soldiers, and they would find pets or whatever running around the trenches, and they'd bring them home. They brought home this miniature dachshund, which were not supposed to be on the ships, brought it up for a walk on board at nighttime. An officer caught him, an officer who had the same kind of view of discipline, iron discipline, as Kyler. So he ordered the dog to be thrown overboard. And as Kyler watched, you know, this dog trying to swim to catch up and watched it die, you know, that brought something into his heart, and he thought, what have I become? Really, what? How can I bring this cruelty back with me?
And you say time and time and time again the savagery of this. And you talk about your cousin, Colonel York?
Sergeant York? He was promoted to sergeant.
He was promoted to sergeant. He was corporal at the time.
You talk about how many people he killed before his conscience kicked back in. You talk about over and over again that on both sides, people just going out and murdering.
Right.
This was no longer war. This was revenge. This was evil, more or less incarnate. Right. And the savagery of it was truly overwhelming.
Right. Now, for most of them, like for York, though, their humanity remained. You know, the story with York, we always hear about, you know, his bravery and how he shot the Germans with his 45 and captured 132 prisoners. But we don't hear the story of what he did the next day. Is that he felt awful about the people that he had killed. And he begs his officer, his captain, to be allowed to go back to the battlefield and see if he can find anybody to save. He said he didn't care if it was an American, German, who it was. He wanted to save somebody, and he's walking around this battlefield calling out for somebody's name and in tears because of this guilt that he had. And again, everybody reacts differently. And I'd want to emphasize that, is that many of them, you know, they felt awful. They were forced to fight during the battle, but then afterwards they had different ways of dealing with it.
You also quote from Pershing's autobiography, which I found clarifying, because he was, you know, just the apotheosis of spirit and honor above all else, and if the honor meant, you know, killing and being killed, so be it. But at the end of his life, he sort of changed his story. He redefined honor, which I found very interesting.
Right, right, he did. And Pershing's story is complex, too. I'd like to feel that I'm treating him, too, as a human being, though I find him culpable in many respects for what his soldiers went through. Still, he's a human being, and he was in many ways defined by his early experiences, losing his wife and his daughters in a fire, at the Presidio, which was a terrible, you know, wrenching experience, as you can imagine. But I think his way of dealing with that was to live through willpower alone, and that willpower, that will to succeed, to dominate, took over his life, and I think it guided how he handled his army in the war, because he extended that willpower to all of his soldiers. You have the will to victory, and the will to victory is what gets you through.
At all costs.
At all costs.
I also found it interesting, a story I'd never heard, that he kicked himself upstairs, which...
Remarkable.
Frankly, was, within the context, was probably his finest decision. Exactly. But how did that come about?
Right. Well, partway through the battle, the battle began September 26th, goes on for 3 weeks of horrendous fighting, during which almost all the casualties took place, 26,000 dead, 100,000 wounded.
Well, this is the Meuse-Argonne.
The Meuse-Argonne. Mid-October, it's become really such a charnel house that Pershing sees that he's not able to handle it. There are eyewitnesses who say that he's breaking down under the strain. But also he senses that he doesn't really understand how to manage this battle. And he kicks himself upstairs. He moves to a higher position where he can kind of generally oversee the American Expeditionary Force, but his primary responsibility will be to deal with the politicians. And he puts Hunter Liggett in command of First Army, which is fighting the Meuse-Argonne. Hunter Liggett is, you know, a much more sympathetic character to me, because he understands that we need to adapt, you know, our tactics and our strategy to this type of battlefield.
Well, and the first thing he did was go out and up to the front lines, or as close as he could reasonably get, and find out what was really going on. I think we call it intelligence.
Right.
Let's call
with,
it.
With both senses of the word.
Right. Let us return to be intelligent in both senses of the word in just a moment with Edward Lengel. Please join us when we return. Edward Lengel is our guest here on The Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula. Bill Russell and Edward Lengel were just talking about the Meuse-Argonne, part of the World War I experience as seen from the Americans' perspective, and the full look at that campaign is within the larger context of World War I. You call it To Conquer Hell. You talk about intelligence, Bill. How in the world can you be intelligent about conquering hell?
Difficult question. It's a question of there's not one answer to how to handle this situation. I don't think that anybody had the one key that would open up the Meuse-Argonne and allow the American army to win a victory with few or no casualties whatsoever. But
it didn't have to be a slaughterhouse.
Didn't have to be a slaughterhouse. And we were talking about how Pershing kicked himself upstairs and let Hunter Liggett take command of First Army fighting this battle. And Hunter Liggett's idea was gathering intelligence about what's going on at the front, but he was also much more focused on morale. How are the doughboys handling this situation up here? Now, before he came in, the attitude had been, we don't really want to hear about that on the part of
Explicitly, yeah.
There was very little interest in how this kind of fighting, this kind of suffering was affecting the doughboys. Hunter Liggett discovered what had been apparent for a long time, that their morale was collapsing. It was collapsing, and they're put sitting out there under the rain, under the gas, the German bombardments, machine guns, making almost no gain. They would
tremendous smell from all the dead and sure. wounded bodies
no
all
food,
around.
No
them.
Food and no sleep.
And large
right.
rats.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
The size of cats.
But also the experience, at least if you feel you're moving forward, then at least you can justify it in some ways. But so many times in this battle they're told to capture woods or capture a town. And they attack again and again, and they finally take it, and then they find the guys on their flanks haven't advanced far enough, so they have to pull back and give it up. And then
massive.
The next day, they have to take it again.
You also tell a story, I think it's about George Marshall, speaking of intelligence, taking some of the staff officers or officers hanging around headquarters complaining because they didn't get to be heroes, and sending them up to the front lines with carrier pigeons.
Right.
Which was, I thought, just a stunt because, you know, the communications was spotty at best. But that seemed, I mean, that's the kind of imagination and initiative you would like from somebody in that position.
Right.
And George Marshall, once again, who is unknown to most people in America. This is the Marshall Plan, right. Marshall, from the next war. But George Marshall comes out really pretty well in the course of you telling the story.
Right. Marshall was an incredible man, really. He was the guy who handled moving this entire army up to the front. He was solely in charge of it. And two, he was a very creative thinker. This is an example. Kind of the critical problem in fighting in World War I is really the lack of communications, is that the generals, very often, they don't know where their troops are simply because there's no way to get information quickly from the front. So Marshall develops this plan of, you know, using large numbers of carrier pigeons. He sent these young intelligence officers who wanted to see some of the battle. He sent them out during the final advance and, you know, gave them the experience and actually helped the army at the same time.
Well, and this is before carrier pigeons were extinct, and they actually carried messages.
This is passenger pigeons. You're
confusing passenger pigeons. But the idea
you can ride to battle on a passenger pigeon. Carrier pigeons just carry messages. Right?
And it worked. And you talk about one poor, sorry little carrier pigeon who comes back with one wing this way, but had he this little pigeon not made it, then they've got runners. And of course, it's hard to not remember that Hitler was a runner in World War I. It's also, now we're talking about real people here. Harry Truman is another little remembered, but a very good officer with a very rich set of language skills. How'd I do?
He kind of had to be because his battery was made up of Irishmen from Kansas City who were notorious for full-scale fist fights, you know, and free-for-all. So He kind of had to be feisty to keep his unit running.
The fact that you have done this from the bottom up and have made real people out of this has brought to life that about which America doesn't want to talk.
Right. It's one of the things I was going to say is that a lot of known characters, well-known characters, will pop up in this book. James M. Cain, the novelist, and Damon Runyon, the journalist. Obviously, Marshall was there. MacArthur was there. MacArthur doesn't come off too well.
He doesn't change any.
Truman was there. But I think one of the things that should bring to mind is that really so many of these people, you know, they later become, you know, leaders in American society. And it helps to remind us that really this war did transform an entire generation. I keep finding as I read more after I wrote the book, more and more people I didn't realize had been there, had experienced this. And I just read recently, I found out that Busby Berkeley had been there.
That's where he got his choreography.
Yeah, the choreographer. And he developed his style of musicals from his experience in the war. So it's interesting.
There's one other of the usual suspects we haven't talked about, the media, the role of the media. And I think I would particularly with respect to the one thing that I think people might remember, or at least the name, and that's the Lost Battalion. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, to me, the most obvious place, at least by your presentation, of how the media finally intersected,
right,
with this war, and it basically ends badly.
Yeah.
In spite of all the good, you know, all the hoopla around it, can you do a short course on that?
The Lost Battalion is one of the few areas where Americans are actually interested in what the Doughboys went through in World War I, because it makes a good story.
No, entertainment.
It has, you know, it's good. Has good entertainment value. Really, you have, you know, this battalion of troops. It wasn't really a battalion. It was a mixture of two battalions, from who were a mixture of New York City's toughest.
Some, you know, of mobsters.
Guys. Yeah, mobsters. There's some mobsters in there. You know, from the toughest neighborhoods in New York City, mixed in with completely green farm boys. This was the way the Army did things in World War I.
They hadn't met before. It's not like they'd gone through training together.
Right, exactly. And they're caught behind the German lines in the Argonne Forest. I visited there last year. It's incredible. It's all as it was at the time. And they're caught behind the lines, and the Germans are attacking them constantly, and this goes on for 5 days. That they're trapped there.
With no food, with no water, with no anything.
Right.
Anything.
No care for the wounded. And it's a terrible experience. So, you know, I could go on at length telling the story, but I won't. But anyway, they bond together. They survive. The Germans make one final attack. Essentially, you have like Bastogne in World War II. You know, the Germans offer to treat them honorably as prisoners and ask them to surrender. And Charles Whittlesey, the American commander, pretty much just ignores them or says nuts. They treat it as a joke. And they're able to fight the Germans off, and they survive. But there's a tragic subplot to this which people are not interested in as part of the story, which was how this battle haunted not only the soldiers, the individual doughboys who were there, but Whittlesey, the commander. Like many officers who lose large numbers of their men in combat, he felt responsible for every single one. He felt guilty for every single one. And at the end of the war, the media has made such a big deal about the Lost Battalion. Damon Runyon was one of the guys there, you know, using his language to
his hyperbolic skills.
Yeah, right. His hyperbolic skills to blow it up. And at the end of the war, Whittlesey has won the Medal of Honor. He's a great hero, and he's wined and dined, and the politicians love to have him there. But he can't stand it. He is kind of zones out of what they're trying to do with him and how they're trying to use him, you know, as a symbol. And inside, he's tearing himself apart because of his guilt at what happened, and then eventually he kills himself. He gets on a steamer ship to Cuba and leaps overboard. just because he can't bear the thought of these guys who had fought and died there.
You also, there's a part of this that blessedly, when you wrap this up, history is also elusive, and it's not clear what the circumstances were. I mean, we have a stereotype of the Lost Battalion, you know, X, Y, and Z, and it turns out none of that is readily verifiable, up to and including it is conceivable that they actually outnumbered the Germans who were nominally surrounding them.
That's true.
And there's a certain, to me, humbling quality to that in terms of what we think we know, as opposed to the reality that's out there.
There are a lot of myths about the Lost Battalion. There are myths about Alvin C. York as well. And it's difficult to get to the truth. You know, York, for example, probably was not solely responsible for capturing all 132 Germans. We forget his unit was there too, and they also helped to capture these Germans. The Lost Battalion, this is one myth, but there are many others as well.
Lest we forget, this is a bad idea to forget, To Conquer Hell, the Meuse-Argonne in 1918, is the specific of what we're talking about with Edward Langle. We will be back in just a moment. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, for a few more minutes. Do join us. A couple more minutes with Edward Langle, who has opened up the First World War for us to look at carefully and thoughtfully. I go back to my childhood. There were two men who lived in the neighborhood who were reclusive and lived in a little hovel almost, and lived off of very meager lives. And we were told never to call them doughboys, that might upset them. And they were brothers, veterans of the First World War. And all we knew was they'd been gassed, whatever that meant, and they had shell shock, whatever that meant. What is this doughboy thing? What's that word?
Where does it come from? Nobody is really certain where the word doughboy originates from. I think probably the most convincing story that I've heard is that it originates from the Mexican expedition, when Pershing's troops were riding through these adobe villages, and this white dust covered the troops to make them look like they were made out of dough, and they were called doughboys then. But I've heard zillions of other stories. But as far as who they were as people, you think about the doughboy next to the GI, next to Johnny Reb, Billy Yank, the Minuteman. Who is he? He's a mystery. He's been lost. There were many facets to him. He was overwhelmingly, many of them were immigrants. They were the first to experience this type of warfare. They were really the trailblazers, unwillingly, for modern war in American society. But they're also really a group to be admired in how they were able to learn and adapt so quickly. I think that really sets them apart.
I found myself going, but there are enough parallels, I found myself laying out legacies that we're still living with. There's some obvious macro, the entire Middle East is a legacy of the First War, the destruction essentially of the Ottoman Empire and the division of the countries that were not countries by the Allied powers. You also talk about the, and I think this is more substantive, the subtle changes in how soldiers saw essentially the social contract. And also the relationship between society and those people we send out to do our killing for us, right. But they're and all of these things have not gone away. You can find traces and legacies going all the way back, directly back to this war, that affect us dramatically today.
Right.
What are some of those in your mind?
At the beginning of that war, the idea had always been that fighting is something that you do as a debt to your society. It's your duty to your society. World War I creates for the first time this idea that society also owes something to the soldiers, that there is a sense of entitlement, that it goes both ways. In particular, you think about the Bonus Army, during the Great Depression, and how Now, these soldiers got practically nothing from the state when they came back. Like other soldiers in other wars, they had trouble adapting, they had trouble finding jobs, they had trouble readjusting to
society. And many of them were functionally disabled.
Yeah, and functionally disabled and physically disabled as well. Many of them, you think how many whose lungs were ruined by gas as well.
To say nothing of shell shock.
And shell shock, which was not understood well at that time. You know, mental illness, all the post-traumatic stress was not understood, but you see it in all the stories that the veterans told. But for the first time, you know, the veterans really forced society to realize that, you know, you need to help us. You need to help us get back into society. You need to support us and give us pensions. And it developed really that idea of the social contract.
I'm amazed at how many things, as Bill's saying about legacy, are so current with this. Bill, I'm sorry, you were about to say?
I found myself thinking about the promises that were made when you talk about that sense of entitlement. There were promises made in the Revolutionary War that were not carried out. There were promises made during the War of 1812. There were promises made in the Civil War. To troops, to African Americans, to lots of different people. We're still doing that today. The scandal is another way to describe it at Walter Reed Hospital. Is one more example. As long as they're over there and sort of out of the way and doing what they're supposed to do, we talk a lot about supporting them.
Right.
But we consistently fail to deliver on that social contract. That we have not, that's not only implicit, but in most cases it has been made explicit, and almost inevitably we let the veterans down.
And people just don't want to think about it. What astounds me is how little attention has been given to the wounded, and to those who've, again, been physically or mentally disabled in the Iraq War. We keep count of how many have been killed, just as a number.
Americans.
Yeah, just Americans. No attention to the bodies coming home. No attention, really, with the exception of this Walter Reed scandal. Kudos to the Washington Post for bringing that out.
I went and looked at a map. That hospital, as best I could tell, is within walking distance of Congress and the White House. There's a willing blindness.
Right.
That is, to me,
unacceptable.
Almost, well, it's unacceptable. It's almost pathologically cynical.
Right. Mm.
And again, it's not that we haven't experienced this before. We know what's going to happen if we do not exercise leadership, judgment, and more than anything, probably responsibility with respect to these people we're asking to die for us.
And to kill for us.
That's right. Right. And it's so important to remember. It's so important to look back to the past and to draw those parallels with the present. Again, when you look at this war and World War I, it astounds me that Americans don't want to think about it. It's just too ugly. It's just too bloody. It's just like with Iraq today. It's disappeared from the media for the last few months. It's
not,
disappeared.
Not fun anymore.
Completely.
Well, we thank you for bringing it back to life and death and to conquer hell. Edward Lingle, it's been quite an experience. Thanks for the ride.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Like World War I itself, Edward Lengel's book, To Conquer Hell, is an important story of real people with real consequences. We thank Dr. Lengel for giving us tools for putting America's history to work, and we thank him for joining us here. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.